Our guest today is Jeff Murray, K1NSS. And hello, Jeff. How are you today?
I'm very well, Ted. How about you?
Doing pretty good. Now, what I want you to tell us about, and I've gone up and looked, and boy, I'll tell you, there's some stuff up here. Jeff has got a website. It's called, where it's www.dashtoons, and that's spelled D-A-S-H-T-O-O-N-S. .com. Don't think of tunes like song tunes, like T-U-N-S. It's tunes like cartoons. www.dashtoons.com. And I guess I want to say, tell me a little bit about this website.
Well, it's I started doing it when I got turned down by QST and CQ magazine back in 2005, which is probably might be the genesis of many sorts of misadventures, but in any event, I decided to try it as a web comic. I've been a cartoonist for some time before, primarily in the mid '80s, for alternative papers in New York and Boston, different places around the country. But these were non-ham radio cartoons, and I always wanted to do something related to ham radio, but they're really, aside from the QST and CQ, there was no place to do it. But about 2000, this is about 2000, almost 2006, the technology and the bandwidth and everything was kind of converging, so you could put up pretty big graphics and they would load pretty quickly for most people. So I put up Dashtoons. Just as a point of information, the character's full name is Dash the Dog-Faced Ham, but he was originally known as, at least in my print, when I was pitching it as a print, was Sparks Barkley. But I decided to go with Dash because he's based on miniature wire-haired dachshund that has since passed on to a better place, but he used to interrupt my QSOs and whatnot, popping the vox with his barks when he wanted me to get off the air. So I decided to call him Dash, for one, because he was some people refer to dachshunds as dash hounds, and then he was long like the Morse Dash. So I thought that might be might work on a number of levels. So it became Dash the Dog-Faced Ham on the web, and I've been doing him pretty much ever since.
Wow. Well, yeah, this requires a sense of humor, does it not?
Well, we're open to everybody here, sense of humor or not. I mean, it can maybe perhaps the it can be colorful, so there's something appealing there, perhaps.
Well, the reason why I say is because hams, as a rule now, have kind of been branded as a hyper serious bunch of men with radios.
Well, I've known some pretty funny hams, actually, and I'm sure you have too.
We're just absolutely
kind of talking in these easy stereotypes here that have nothing to do with reality. I know, but I've known some very funny hams. I had ones that were contemporaries of mine. I kind of grew up in the. I was a ham when I was a kid in the '60s, and we had some pretty funny times. We had kind of a gang of high school, junior high, high school age hams, and we had a lot of laughs. And I, met a lot of guys in various in clubs and things that I've been in who were pretty funny guys. And so there's plenty of material. And then certainly you get people like, I mean, my hero, as far as funny people goes, is something someone certainly a lot of hams know is Gene Shepard. I've always been a huge fan of his stuff, and wish I could he's my hero as far as any being creative and funny and everything. Love his stuff.
Go ahead. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Jeff Murray, right after this.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper. If you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello. Tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win, and let's see who the lucky winners will be. You're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Jeff Murray, K1NSS.
Gene Shepherd was a ham. I'm sure probably everybody listening is familiar with him, but so some of the younger people may only know him as the author of the Christmas Story, that movie that's become kind of a Christmas classic. But he had a long history on WRAM during the 60s and into the 70s, I think. And on the radio, he told a lot more ham stories. He was a ham as a kid and was an active ham, I think, until he passed away. And he talked a lot about ham radio. He's probably of anybody, I think, in almost mainstream. He's fairly mainstream media. He was probably the most visible and the person who brought ham radio most to the general public, and in a really artful way too, very very funny, and they didn't get bogged down in a lot of details. But Gene is my hero, and
I guess I want to say, as far as subject material is concerned, all you've got to do is go to a ham fest and look around. I mean, everybody there is a character. I mean, really, I mean, and I'm not saying that from a negative or no negativity intended at all. Matter of fact, what I'm saying is when you get out into the general public, you get lost in a sea of people that all look the same. You walk into a ham fest, you've got a whole bunch of real characters there. And these are all... Go ahead.
We show up there, Ted. So we add to that mix, you know.
Well, yeah, and it makes it interesting, because I think hams are some of the most interesting, creative, different people in the whole world. I mean, these are people that they only made one of this kind, and it came out of the mold, and there they are. You know, I mean, and you're not going to see another one just like them. I mean, I remember walking around Dayton last year. What little bit of chance I had to walk around Dayton, because we were broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And seeing these guys with the backpack radios and the antennas mounted on their hats, And their vests just full of buttons and trinkets and things. And everybody was taking pictures of them. I mean, you know, now, you know, those guys are having fun. They're having more fun than what the law ought to allow, you know.
Right.
Because everybody's running
around.
You
got to think, too, though, that the people who are there taking pictures of them, if you went back to their homes, they'd all have, like, these giant balls of string they've been saving since 1945. So it really is, you know, a huge mix of eccentric and colorful people. I worked in the earlier part of this past decade. I worked at Ham Radio Outlet on Saturdays in Salem, New Hampshire. And in case any of those guys are listening, hi to all. I really enjoyed my time there. It was amazing, the people who would walk through the door. I was there filling in on Saturdays because that tended to be they had a bit more traffic that day, and the range of people was staggering. I mean, we get people that were these internationally famous atomic physicists. And other people, you know, guys who I remember there was one guy who repaired trucks. He had one of those enormous tow trucks that pulled tractor units and whatnot. And his specialty, he had that huge tow truck kitted out with all kinds of mobile equipment. And he was into county hunting, and he would go up into the northern counties of New Hampshire and had some great stories about collecting, running into people, and some of just the everyday the color of his work was fascinating. And even among the people who worked there, there was one guy, Steve, who was a former SR-71 pilot who would fly. He would fly the Blackbird plane. And he's just had some amazing stories. So you get people from so many different walks of life, and generally they're thoughtful, very, very thoughtful people. And ham radio is like the common thread.
Well, I know when I was talking about the fellas with the backpack radios and the antennas on their hats and all that kind of stuff. What's really unusual, if you think about this, they're walking around Dayton and people are running up taking pictures of them. I wonder how many thousands of people actually wind up viewing these guys by means of pictures when hams return to their hometown. I mean, do we have any idea? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, you know, a fellow walking around Dayton has no idea, you know, how much photo activity there's going to be and how many of these pictures are going to get posted on the internet and viewed by people everywhere, you know. So
I don't know. I think some of these everybody's very, very media savvy now, and people are into, you know, self promotion and want to anything to generate traffic. I think that guy with the I know there's the guy with the helmet cam. I'm sure he has a website.
Tom Medlin, yes. And he's
yeah.
Oh, you know, and it's funny, you know, he when he goes to the Huntsville Hamfest, he I guess he does it to Dayton too. He televises the travel to and from. He's got the cams on going to and from and all that. Only ham operators would do things like this, you know, And see, there you have it. You know, Tom Medlin, and I know if I say this, it's not going to offend him. He is a very colorful character. He is somebody that's got personality. He's got innovative ideas. And what I like about your cartoons is that I think in anything and everything today, if you can't find a little humor, you know, you better go back to bed, because you're not going to do anybody any good. If you can't find a little humor in something. So anyhow.
The thing of it is, I think there's so much in ham radio that's funny, and just the sort of the whole idea of technology itself being funny and getting it down to the level of, you know, resistors and barrier strips and stuff like that. This whole kind of amateur geek, it's not even a ham radio so much. It's just people that tinker and all that sort of thing. And I'm interested in kind of preserving a bit of that world. And one way to do it, I mean, you can approach all this stuff very sort of academically and whatnot and make a study of it. But I think it's a lot more fun to kind of, and you can kind of cover a lot more. You can kind of get serious about stuff as long as your character has the head of a dachshund. You know, you can pretty much do anything, and you won't be accused of being too serious about things. But it's a sort of the private life of growing up with ham radio, that kind of thing. That sort of secret history that, you know, Ham's experience and everything, but the rest of the outside world doesn't. And now that's a problem. If you're creating stuff, for a long time I tried to write fiction and write some fiction involved with ham radio, and it was very, very difficult because there's so much to explain. You know, you got to normal people, so to speak. So. Finally, I decided, well, I'm just not going to explain anything. I give up, you know, and I'll just write to hands, you know, and I thought with the internet and everything that it's easier to reach that kind of a niche audience nowadays than through, you know, because you're never going to get there. I mean, they're never going to publish stuff like this in QST or CQ, just because. I don't know why. I mean, I understand why they don't. And I got, you know, when I submitted stuff initially to a QST, I got a very, very nice letter from Steve Forbes, but it's just not in the cards, and it was probably all for the best anyway. So, but on the internet, I mean, you can do, you know, you can just do whatever you want, and I have. And it's been a ball.
Well, I think that, you know, and I will say this because I'm a member of the ARL. I think sometimes the league is a little bit too stodgy. I think they lack a sense of humor in a lot of respects. I think a lot of times they're way too serious. And I'm a member, and I tell people to join. You know, if you want the organization to loosen up a little bit and you want to have more fun out of ham radio, then you don't walk away from the group, because if you do, then all you're going to have are the stick in the muds that are left. It's going to really get,
you know, I mean, I understand they have sort of they're kind of the keepers of tradition. And, you know, one thing that always struck me about, you know, the part of the tradition that they have is the cartoons of Gil Gildersleeve. And you're probably familiar with his stuff, and probably, you know, just about everybody in the audience is too. Because his cartoons, I mean, he was doing stuff for QST, I think from the 30s on into the 60s, and his imagery, his cartoons are so wrapped up into the DNA of ham radio. I mean, it's impossible for me, when I think of ham radio, not to think of his stuff. And it's not that it was so funny, really. I mean, but it was just interesting. It was just cool. That whole sort of 30s, 40s kind of retro look that his cartoons had was really, really pleasing and really well done. And, you know, it was all about open wire feeds and all that kind of, you know, tubes, and had all the cool stuff. And it was just great to see it in print. And it's one of, you know, it's one of the real treasures that QST has. And I can see why they, you know, they pretty much limit their stuff to his stuff nowadays. There used to be, do you remember John Troster, W6ISQ? And I he may still be alive, so I hope I'm not, I hope he is. But he used to write some very, very funny pieces for QST back in the 60s. And it was, things about conscious stuff related to amateur radio. And, I always I loved that as a kid. And let's seek his stuff out.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something.
As I did Gil. So I've been a fan of that stuff. And I think it's just sad that there isn't more sort of humor that's a little more up to date.
Well, here's the thing. when you're talking about humor and the keepers of tradition, there is nobody that had a, what do I want to say, a better sense of humor, a wry sense of humor, but the sense of humor was way out front, other than Hiram Percy Maxim. You know, this man is the guy that conceived the idea of the wolf hong. You'll look at the picture of this thing, you know, and the whole idea that we torture the bad ham operators, the guys that misbehave. We tortured them with this thing. Then the ready snitch.
The ready snitch. You beat me to it.
Yeah, yep. That thing. I mean, scare, you know, you can have dreams about that thing. And then on top of that, in Newington at league headquarters, there is an award sitting on a shelf somewhere. I haven't seen it because I haven't been there. I plan on going. I think we're going to try to do a remote broadcast if they don't kick us out. but anyways, there's an award sitting there for the first radio amateur that makes contact with Mars. Okay.
Oh, right. Is that the Hugo Gernsback thing?
No, that's all Hiram Percy Maxim. I mean,
he
was a madman. I mean, you know, he had a lot of fun with ham radio. And see, that's the thing. If it was good enough for Hiram Percy Maxim, I don't want to hear anybody today talk about, well, we have to keep the tradition, you know. No, you know, that's crazy. I mean, this man was a genius. You know, he was an inventor. Mm-hmm. You know, he made gun silencers and all kinds of things. He had patents all mm-hmm. over the place. The man was a genius. And,
right.
You know, he is our, I guess, modern-day father of amateur radio, and that's his call sign, is where they get W1AW from. So,
sure.
You know, I think that we have to look at him, and not that he was perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but if he was allowed a sense of humor and thought it to be a good thing, then I think that's part of the tradition that we must keep going. Now, I know they do have the wolf hong ceremonies and things that they have, but there's really not enough participation in that, you know, and there really isn't enough participation in the, I guess I want to say, I think at times the fun side of ham radio. I think, mm-hmm. this is Ted's opinion, ham radio has gotten way too serious. And what's happened is it's created it's created kind of a funny equation in that I've noticed that when a couple of guys get on a frequency and they're having fun talking and they're bantering back and forth, there's guys that really get mad. They get angry, you know, because I just can't believe I'm hearing something like this on ham radio, you know. And I'm not talking about people QRMing and breaking the law. I'm talking about people just having fun. And when I was younger, I used to hear guys on AM, and they would get on back and forth, and they would banter about, and they would have fun. And it was intriguing. It made you smile. It made you laugh. You know, and ham radio should make you laugh. There should be things about ham radio that puts a smile on your face.
Sure.
It shouldn't always be a tornado drill. And, you know, I mean, I really seriously, that's how I feel about it. And, of course, I've got a lot of people listening, so I guess if I'm going to get somebody mad, boy, I'm really going to get it, you know. But I really believe that. And I think it's been way too serious for way too long. And I think what happens when you do that, and I don't know, maybe we should get a psychologist to come on. I think what happens when you do this, it causes people to have all sorts of pent-up sort of, I don't know what it is, anguish. And then when they misbehave, boy, they really misbehave. So, you know, I think there's a fine line there. So I think the cartoons are excellent. I think this is an excellent idea. And I think there ought to be more cartoons in QST. You know, there ought to be more in CQ Magazine and these other publications. And I think if they really thought about it, and gave it a go around in the head, I think they'd come to that conclusion too. But we're all kind of victims of this way too serious routine, you know, that mm-hmm. that connects itself with ham radio. And I think a good thing that you could use a gauge would be the sense of humor of the young men in uniform that are out fighting, and even in past wars, if you talk to veterans. They'll tell you about the annex and the crazy stuff they did. They had to have a sense of humor, you know, without that, you know. Well, anyways, let's back up just a little bit, and now let's let's get just a little bit serious here. I was looking at your website, and you have a Salvation Army logo up in the corner. Tell me a little bit about that, and are you affiliated with the Salvation Army?
No, no, not at all. I just when the earthquake happened in Haiti, I just thought it would be, you know, there was, I wanted to make some connection with some charity for people on the site, and I, they've always been kind of a pet charity for me in the past, just you know, sort of walking around thing, and it seemed like they are, you know, they're old school, based in the United States a long time. Their appeal to me is strictly secular, but they just always seem to do a lot of good in a lot of places in this country and abroad. And I understand that there's some that they have some ham radio connection too, in Haiti, but in general around the world, I think, in their relief efforts. So I thought it would be I thought it would help out. That's all.
Well, I know the ARL works a lot with the Salvation Army, because I've heard Alan Pitts talk about the Salvation Army and their connection with them. But you know, if you're ever at the point where you're bored, you don't have anything to do, go hang out at your local Salvation Army headquarters, because there's plenty to do. They have their thrift stores. They help families. I think they're a wonderful organization. One of the best organizations that we have in the USA today that you can trust 100% as far as, you know, what they do, especially if you donate money or you donate things to them, or even if you donate time. They're just an incredible organization. I have a lot of respect for the Salvation Army. And I have friends of mine that have been in situations where the Salvation Army was literally saving lives by just their presence there. So I just saw the insignia. I thought I'd ask, because I don't see a Salvation Army insignia much on amateur radio websites or things like that. Well, tell me about your ham radio history. What in the world whatever caused you to want to get into ham radio?
I tie it all back in my book, the first book of Dash. I get into some of that. I received a Remco radio station when I was, I don't know, when I was like five or six or something like that, and I've always had a bug for radio ever since then. You know, I got the crystal sets and
now let me ask you a question. The Remco radio station, now was that a crystal set, or was that actually a broadcasting thing?
Well, they had several iterations of it. I had the first one. I'm not old, but it was essentially just a microphone hooked up to a speaker, and it was this kind of it was like this plastic control board, and it had a couple of towers on it, and you just talked into the microphone and it came out the speaker. So that was essentially, it had a code, had a key too. It had a little plastic straight key, and it had a pad to write down all the CW you'd be copying, which wasn't a lot, but it was fun, and I just always had a thing for control boards too. So that the whole idea is, you know, it's always intrigued me. This is, you know, something in general which I find fascinating about ham radio and just radio in general, is the whole idea of people sitting in little rooms in front of little boxes or big boxes with dials on them for hours and hours on end. And I'm one of them. I'm not talking about some, you know, strange breed of people, or I am, but I'm talking about myself. It's fascinating. But that always really appealed to me as a kid, and I just kind of kept on. And, you know, they make the natural progression from the Remco toy to the crystal set to the Night Kid Ocean Hopper. I had my first call was WPE2GEP, as issued by Popular Electronics, the quasi-governmental organization that it was. I did that, and then I went from that to got my novice license. Was WN2EXW in something like 1962, and then I got my general, and, you know, I was in freshman in high school or something like that, and did that for a couple more years, and then, like everybody, or like a lot of people, I just kind of, I did. I kind of traded in my ham equipment for an electric guitar and went my way for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. But I kept dreaming about, boat anchors
let me ask you a question. How many DX contacts did you make on that electric guitar?
Well, I met a few girls through that, but that which was nice. But and I can't say the DX context helped me that way. But it's true. I mean, the radio. Once you catch that radio thing, you're stuck for life, one way or another. You may not get a license, but I don't know. It just kept bugging me. So I got back in 2000 and. Got back on as a general, and I got a vanity call, K1NSS. That's kind of a tribute to the station that taught me with a D, E, N, and S in code. You know, they would play that loop of code over and over again on HF. They used to when they were on the air, and. So I love the sound of that on CW, so I took that as my vanity call, and the rest is ham radio history.
Well, you know, the thing that you did, you admitted to having a WPE call.
Proud of it.
A WPE certificate or whatever it is from, was it Popular Communications, wasn't it, or Pop Electronics?
Popular Electronics. I think Tom... Is it? I'm not sure how to pronounce. Is it Nitel? Tom Nitel was behind that. He was a writer on things shortwave and maybe ham too in the '60s. I think a lot. And so he was involved with Popular Electronics started that.
Everybody out of the sun had one of those WPE things, and I mean they started issuing those, and those were hot. Everybody wanted one. Every shortwave. Listener, everybody that wanted to do shortwave as a hobby had to have a WPE assignment of some sort, and they sent out nice little certificates, and
it was a handsome certificate. It was suitable for framing. And I framed it.
People put those things on their wall. Yeah, they did, and it made it fun. And then I guess when they would report into what they had listened to or what they had. Some rare station, they would all get published in the magazine, along with their WPE number. You know, so that was really official. When you first got your novice license, of course you'd probably done a lot of shortwave listening. You mentioned the Ocean Hopper. Tell folks what the Ocean Hopper was. A lot of people that don't know what an Ocean Hopper was.
Well, an Ocean Hopper was I believe, three-tube regenerative kit from Night Kit, sold by Allied Radio. And I guess they had been selling it for quite a while, and again, different iterations. But the one I got was the one with... I think it had a 50 C5 audio output, a 35 CW4 rectifier, and I can't remember what the actual detector was. But anyway, it was a regenerative set, and the coolest thing about it was, at least from my perspective at the time, it was real retro. And it came in the cabinet had a trap door in it, which was, you know, to a sixth grader. I mean, it was the only thing the thing was missing was like a cutlass and a monkey. You know, it was like a pirate ship thing or something. You know, with the trap door and the plug-in coils, and you know, you could fantasize that you were, you know, it was like being in an Indiana Jones movie, all in a little box there. You know, it's just that whole sort of 30s ambiance, which really appealed to me as a kid. I liked that, as much as I was into all the chrome and all the pilot lights and everything. That sort of that retro thing really grabbed me. So that was my first receiver. I went from that to a Lafayette HE40, which was like the other end of the the spectrum in terms of chrome, and it was essentially a clock radio without a clock, and a little bit more frequency coverage. And from there, I went to, oh, this could go on for a long time, Ted. I don't know how long you want to keep up with it. But it does. From that, I went to a Super Pro, Hammerlin Super Pro, which I bought for, I think, $35 from these twins who, you know, let's talk about ham radio characters. I bought it from these two twin kids and who went around in these mechanics uniforms all the time, and they took my Lafayette HE40 in trade for the Super Pro, and I think $35 or something like that, and it was that was I was in heaven with that thing, because that was 18 tubes, two units actually, power supply, the whole thing weighed 100 pounds. And I was in heaven with that. As far as transmitters go, I was all Heathkit, DX20 and then DX40, and I had a tour as well. So that's pretty much my equipment as a kid anyway. My operating, I did a lot of CW. CW came really hard to me, and it was kind of like the first hard thing I ever had to do. And the first thing I ever forced myself to do, and it was a learning. It was it made me everything I am today, I think. But it was a useful thing, and I came to really like CW, and I did that as that was primarily what I did as a general, work DX and
well, CW. Now, coming up in the ranks of ham radio, getting your novice ticket. Who were the players around you at the time? I mean, were you working with an Elmer? Was there people there trying to give you a hand with this, or were you out in the boat alone?
I was pretty much out in the boat alone, although there were people that, you know, maybe I should take that back, because come to think about it, the strange thing back then, and this was like the early 60s, was that there were hams all over the place. And I mean, around your neighborhood, there was a ham maybe three doors away, and then another one, on a next street. So there were, you know, people to see, but, you know, the whole deal then, I think, kids were less, there was just less, you know, kids were afraid, basically, of adults, or I was anyway. So, I pretty much kept to myself. So you sort of develop this whole sort of attitude about radio through what you read. You know, you'd read old books about radio, and you know, like 1948 handbooks and stuff like that, old QSTs, and you know, I pretty much came to this whole thing myself, but I did get one guy gave me the novice test, and the other guy actually gave me some parts and things like that, but pretty much on my own. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, was there a local radio club around at that time when you were that age getting your novice ticket?
There was, but I didn't join them until after I was licensed somewhat, and the guy down the street used to give me the ride. That was the Utica Amateur Radio Club. And it was interesting because I just went last summer, I went to their ham fest, and the president of the club was the president of the club when I was there as a kid. And it was David Geiser, and he didn't I remembered him because he was the only guy in the club that wore a suit to the club meeting as the president, and I was just another face in the crowd at the time, but that was pretty much my club experience. I had some friends who had been, some of my kind of ham radio gang there. We all went to the club, and we kind of hung out together and hung out with the kind of hung out with all the loose cannons that were in the club. You know, these are the guys that were the wise guys and stuff, the adults. And we thought it was great when they'd put on some of the other more serious members and stuff like that. So that was my experience with clubs as a kid.
So who all did you talk to on this Heathkit tour you had? Now, you had a tour, so, I mean, those are the early days of the 2 meter AM radio. So how did that work out?
Well, that was kind of like my ham radio buddies. We got into that 2 meter thing sort of somewhat later in our ham careers, and it was the usual kid stuff, almost like a telephone. Although I do remember lying in bed and talking to some of the locals, local VHF guys there, and some really interesting discussions with. I remember there was one guy who's an engineer for GE, and he was talking about working on the black boxes that went into the planes that were flying over Hanoi at the time, and he's saying how that, you know, the black boxes would work. They would keep the, you know, the missiles would be flying up like telephone poles and all around the guys in the F-4s, and you know, that they really helped out a lot. So stuff like that, you know, you really felt like you're kind of on the inside of something, getting some inside dope, and that was fun. But mostly it was just party line kind of chatter with kids. There was, you know, it was interesting, the sort of different groups at the time. There were like there was us. We weren't really there were some more serious VHF guys, and that was like this whole separate cult, and there were a bunch of kids in that too. And they, you know, they would go off on hilltopping and do all sorts of, you know, these big collinear 2 meter arrays and stuff like this. But mine was just, you know, a coat hanger out the window, basically, and yada yada yada.
Well, I always got a big bang out of the tour, and that little thumb switch on the thing. Boy, well, that was the only thing about it that made it not fun to operate, and that was you couldn't get. You know, you weren't holding a hand mic, and you weren't back away from the radio. You had to push on that stupid thumb switch, you know. And I often wondered whose bright idea that was, you know, because there were CB radios out at that time, and they all used push-to-talk microphones. I don't know who it was.
Right.
Heathkit that, you know, so we used to always say thumbs down, you know. And
I think the tour was a CB. They did have a CB set that was built around it on a tour chassis, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know what came first, the CB rig or the tour.
Right.
Yeah. And then they made the Sixer, and I don't know. I guess that was it. I think they finally, everybody got tired of that cabinet, and it was so ugly, everybody called it the lunchbox. So
they're right. It was right. And attractively colored as well.
Yeah, Heathkit.
Yeah, that sort of putty color or something.
Yeah, Heathkit should have won the ugly award for that thing. You know, I mean, there should have, if that had been an ugly award, that one would have been the one, okay?
Right.
And then,
yeah.
But they made so many other pieces of gear that was cool looking, like the single sideband exciter, the Heathkit Marauder, with that green those chrome knobs on that thing. And I guess that thing had a matching receiver. I can't remember which one it was, but those were pretty looking. You see those things at a distance, and those knobs sparkled like diamonds to hams that would see that thing at a distance. Well, now what do you engage in now? What kind of activity on ham radio are you into today? What tickles your fancy today?
No, it's primarily contesting, casual contesting, and it's a chance to get on and make a lot of contacts, and not have to work too hard. I mean, I don't really, you know, go at it. That's what people say who have no chance, you know, who have miserable scores, and that's the excuse you go on and say, well, I'm not very serious about it. But I like to do that, but I actually like to do that on phone rather as opposed to CW. As much as I enjoy CW, I find CW contesting that's hardcore. You know, you know, it's not the speed, but it's just the frenetic nature of it. Mel makes me too nervous and everything, so I just stick to the contesting I do on sideband. And I was in the New York QSO party this year, had a lot of fun in that, and pretty much those kind of things. And then I like casual DXing too. I loved 30 meter CW. You know, it just seems more sort of relaxed. You can pick up different people, and 160 as well. I like a CW rag chewing actually on 160. I might go on there every so often. I'm in a place now where I can have an actual full size half wave 160 meter dipole, which is just staggering compared to some of the other places I've been, and it's great. I mean, it's not up high or anything like that, but it's just the idea of having that much wire outside is exciting enough. I've never had a beam, or I've never had any of that super equipment. I've always had small stuff. Nowadays I use a little Icon 1718, and it's just great. You know, it's got everything. It does everything I want to do, except could use a little more selectivity in CW. But I mean, there it is, and it's this little box, and it works fine. And I, you know, like everybody else, I've got a collection of a minor collection of old stuff, which a lot of times some of it which I use for models for drawing from. And I got a pair of headphones old magnetic phones which I invested in, and that's my chief artist model right now, those phones, because I do stuff, use them all the time. So that's pretty much what I do on ham radio. I'm not in a club per se. There are clubs around here and stuff, but I haven't gotten into that. The working on Dash is pretty much a full-time thing. I'm retired, and I spend an awful lot of time in the sitting in a chair in front of boxes, and then to sit in a different chair in front of other boxes is not really appealing to me after about 8 hours. But I do get on the weekends and stuff like that.
Well, you know what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to send us some special Dash tunes that we can stick up on the QSO website with a link back to your site. And that way, as folks go up to download their podcast, they can check out the latest Dash tune. And
well, let me tell you, Ted, and to any people that are listening now on editors of newsletters, you know, club editors and the website people, anything on the website pretty much is any of the things that are on the site are available for you can just take them right off the site and use them on your own newsletter and club. I'll send you some, but if anyone's, you know, anyone is with a club and would like to have them in their paper or on their site, they're welcome just to go on and copy them off. Right now I do have the one thing and one exception I need to say is I do have a free chapter from my book, and I wish you wouldn't take those, but other than that, everything else is up for grabs, and you're free to use for non-profit purposes. I've got clip art up there too, which is free for non-profit use, and that's one of the things that I tried to build Dash on from the beginning, and that's with providing, you know, some sort of a content support for club editors, and we try to cater to them as much as I can, and deliver stuff in the form, you know, format that they need and whatnot. And I've really gotten a lot of help from some great places in South Africa and New Zealand, and then all over the U.S. too. Special help from the guys at K9YA, the Telegraph e-zine. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, it's a great e-zine with a lot of very, very literate and well thought out pieces on various aspects of ham radio in the past and currently. And it's K9 Yankee Alpha. People look that up. And I've also done some collaborations with some other spots, with some couple of blogs, which are a great contest blog. That's Kilo Alpha 3 Delta Radio, which is all on radio sports, Scott out in California. And then you were talking about humor. There's another great, there's a very ham radio humor site, which is specializes in contests and DX humor. That's just a very niche thing, but it's called the Fine Eye Report. That's Fox India dash November India Report, and that's a reference to the 5-9 in contesting. And the slogan is "Life's too short to enunciate," and that's put on by his nom de guerre is Cousin QRM. And so if you check out the Fine Eye Report, that's another great place.
I'm going to have to check out these. I'm learning something here. I don't know about these two. Well, we'll have to get them on the radio and talk a little bit about their website.
I'm sure he would. I can give you his secret email address if you'd like to get him on, because he's very entertaining, and I know he'll be a hit with your listeners.
There you go. Well, you can give me that off the air.
Sure.
When we get ready to bring this to a close. Well, now, for young amateur radio operators, this is a gentleman that's been through the ranks, started off as a shortwave listener, and with his Ocean Hopper and Crystal Radio, Remco radio station. I remember those things. Remember them advertising them on the on television. You know, you'd see those things on TV, and of course, have times changed. Holy cow, I don't even want to think about it. But anyhow, he started off there. He now has this website called dashtunes.com, and we want to make sure that folks go up and check that out. And it's simply DashTunes, DashToons.com. And this this all features Dash the Dog-Faced Ham. And there's some really good stuff up there. There's some real cute stuff. And we want you to check that out. And so now let me ask you this question. What would you say to young people today, anybody that's tuned in and listening, there's shortwave listeners thinking, I don't know if I want to get a ham license or not. What would you tell them?
I tell them, head for the hills. It's all a bunch of fat old guys. No. That's not true. It's not really like that. There's a lot of stuff. It's a whole other world now with computers and satellites and stuff that we never had, or I never had at any rate, and might have dreamed about and gone crazy at the time. But there's lots to do, and it's entree to I think the coolest thing. I know I've talked with kids of friends and things like that, and they really get excited about Morse code. That people really latch on to that, which is surprising. Kind of, it's counterintuitive to me, actually, because I was so originally afraid of it as a kid. But a lot of kids are into that, and then the whole digital satellite thing is very, very cool too. So there's plenty of good stuff to do. And it's the truth of it is it's weird stuff, but weird stuff is cool. So what are you going to do?
Well, I will say this: it's strange because we were located next to the booth for Vibroplex at one of our live broadcasts, and I talked to those guys, and they were saying that since the code restriction on the license has been lifted and it's now a code-free mm-hmm. license, they're selling more keys and bugs than ever. And also Gordon West, who was putting together the code practice tapes, he puts out a set of them, and he also said that his code tapes, the sales went way up after the mm-hmm. the code requirement was listed. I said code restriction. Listen to me. The code requirement yeah. was lifted. That's weird. It is weird, but it's kind of cool because
it's totally cool.
It's like, you know, the mom telling you got to eat your spinach. If she'd never said anything yeah. about it, you'd probably been a big spinach fan. So
I think one that, you know, and to the kids again with the one of the appeals that flips kids out is just how much you're off the grid or off the network at any rate. You know, the fact that you're generating a signal from your backyard to somebody's backyard in Uzbekistan. I mean, it always got me, but the kids now who are used to, I mean, maybe they can talk to you know, Uzbekistan in chat rooms and stuff. But this is totally like you're on your own. You know, you're out of the hive mind and into some sort of independent thing, which is you know, very cool. And I think has a timeless appeal. You know, people want to be able to be independent, to do something a little different, and Ham Radio is the way to do that.
Well, I still want to say hats off to our buddy Chip Margelli. I don't know if you know Chip, but Chip works with Heil Sound. He works with Bob Heil. But he was one of the two fellows that were on the Jay Leno show that did the Morse code versus text messaging, you know. And that was a milestone. That blew a lot of people away. There's people who were totally, completely surprised at the fact that, you know, two guys with a telegraph key can sit there and out communicate the modern day text messaging on a cell phone, you know. And I don't care what kind of cell phone you got, you couldn't keep up with Chip Margelli, okay? Not possible. And of course, the other thing we forget too is our cell phone technology came from amateur radio operators. And I keep saying this, the internet, TCP over IP, two hams invented that. So I mean, you know, you have to look at ham radio for what it is, and I mean, it has been the proving ground and the launching board of almost every kind of technology imaginable. So, but listen, we're out of time. I really appreciate you joining us here. Jeff Murray, K1NSS, and his website is www.dashtoons, that's DASHTOONS.com. If you run an amateur radio newsletter for your club, you may want to go up there and grab one of his clip art pieces and tell your friends and neighbors about his website, because you can go up there and meet Dash the Dog-Faced Ham. And I really appreciate you coming on board with us and talking with us today.
Thank you, Ted. It's been great fun.
And you'll have to come back. And we'll have a link to your website up on the QSO website so folks can find you.
Be careful what you wish for, Ted.
Okay. Thank you. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. LightPack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings. All also, lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPak's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, LightPakSystems.com. That's LightPakSystems.com, spelled LightPakSystems. LightPakSystems.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. You're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Joe Mell.
Our guest is Joe Mell. And his call sign is K0OV. And the subject is a fascinating subject, one that has always interested me. And, of course, we're going to talk about a number of things because this fellow's into a lot of different kinds of things. But the first thing I want to talk to Joe about is radio direction finding, because this is something that that he's really into. How you doing there, Joe?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and I'm curious as to whatever sparked your interest in this, because of all the different areas of amateur radio, this is one. Occasionally you hear about people doing fox hunts, but it's not something that's real common. So tell me what got you into this.
Oh my gosh! I actually went on my first transmitter hunt. I think I was 11 years old. I had a novice class license. This was back in Nebraska. And the local radio club said they were going to do a transmitter hunt. And back then, transmitter hunts, mobile transmitter hunts, were all on the 80-meter band. Now, this is before 2 meters, of course, became popular. And I didn't know the first thing about it, but I was only 11, so I had to get Dad to drive. And he was willing to accommodate me. So what I did is I managed to get my SX-100 Hallicrafters radio, if you know what that is. My goodness, great big old thing, on a vibrator power supply, and stuck it in the front seat of our convertible. And I thought, gee whiz, those antennas on the back of broadcast radios, they're directional. So I wonder if I could use one of those. So I took one of these wicker weave antennas off the back of a little AM radio and hooked it up to this SX-100, and I said, we're going to go on a transmitter hunt. Well, we didn't find the transmitter that day. I made my dad drive all over town, but I was hooked, and I had to, find out more about that. But the local club didn't do any more of it. So nothing really happened until about 1976, and I'm out here in California, and the local radio club is doing transmitter hunts on 2 meters. So I had to join in and build some equipment and get the car all fixed up, and I did, and I hooked, and I've been doing this sort of thing ever since.
Well, let me ask you a question now. For folks that don't know what an SX-100 is, I used to have one, so I know. How many pounds do you think an SX-100 weighs?
Well, it wasn't the weight that was the big problem. It was the size. Of course, it had to sit on the seat and hopefully get strapped in. But it's a big, what we used to call a boat anchor radio. It must have had a dozen tubes in it and two great big half-moon dials, and it was a general coverage receiver. And it was my pride and joy, I got to tell you. It was my present for getting my general class license at the time. I must have been a general because that's when I got it. Must have not been a novice. But anyway, that was a really great shortwave receiver. In fact, I still have it, and I still use it.
Wow. Now, that's cool. Now, what I liked about it, of course, there was the top had a hinge on the back, and you could flip. You could just grab it and flip the top up. It wasn't like screwed down. It was like little things that held it in place, and you could kind of put some
popped right up.
Yeah. And then, of course, you could go in there and with a paintbrush or something and dust out the thing and keep it nice and clean, But, it's funny because after that, after I had one, I wanted the SX-101 real bad,
And that was a handband version, right?
Yeah, and I wound up getting one, and after I got it, I missed the 100. I really did. I was so hooked on that 100. But anyhow, the other thing that got me, they were talking about, you said a vibrator power supply. Did Helicrafters make such a thing, or did you have to rig something?
No, I actually made it one out of parts from an old, you know, back in those days, the AM radios in cars, well, at least the older ones, the new cars had the 12-volt tubes, but the older ones had a vibrator power supply, so I stole one out of an old radio, and of course, you know, I was able to power, I don't remember too well now, but I was able to power the filament somehow from either 6 or 12 volts. There was an octal pin on the back of that set, as you may remember, and you could directly access the filaments and the B+, because it was actually intended as an output to go to converters and things like that, but I used it as an input. And so I powered the filaments off the battery and used the vibrator to give it the B+, and it worked fine.
That's unbelievable. That reminds me back, and I don't want to get too far off the beaten path, but it reminds me when I was young, I used three filament transformers and connected directly into the alternator.
Hmm.
And then what I did is the filament transformer primaries went into the alternator, and I can't remember how exactly they hooked up in there. I was young, and I'm lucky I didn't destroy the automobile. But then the secondaries of the filament transformers all went in series. And I think those windings were 240 volts or something. So by putting them all in series, you came up with about 900 or 1,000 volts. And then I built up an amplifier that ran 811s in the car mobile for. And I ran it. I really only ran it on 40 and 80. I never really got it tuned up on 20, but it worked real well, and those are some.
And you and I both, I did things like that to build oscilloscopes in those days, and of course, we never thought about things like the rating of the transformer windings to the core, because if you're seriesing those things up, there's a pretty good chance you're going to short to the core because of high voltage. And I got lucky, and you apparently got lucky too, and we didn't break anything or kill ourselves.
No, this thing worked fine. You know, there was a I had heard about this. Somebody told me, and I'll tell you who I think it was. It was a ham at the time that used to hang out on 75 meters on 3895, and his call sign was K8RXW. And his name was Ken Kiefer up in Peyton City, West Virginia, I believe. I think I got this right. And I think he's the one that put me onto this. And I did it, and it worked. It worked really well. Okay, so now you've got your SX100 in the back seat of the car, and you're using a almost like a loop antenna.
It was a loop, yes.
A wire loop like what you'd used to see on the back of an AM radio is what you're saying, basically.
Right. It was a multi-turn thing. It looked like a wicker basket.
Now, how good would that work in order to be able to?
It didn't, because I didn't have it resonated.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I didn't know that. I didn't figure that out until later. And by the time I figured out what I was doing wrong, there weren't any more transmitter hunts. I guess everybody else kind of got tired of it at that point, and I was going to be off to college pretty soon, so it went away. And so I learned a few things, but I didn't really learn a lot until later.
Well, I want to ask a question before we get too far down the road, because this is something I've had people ask me, is if I would know the answer. And that is, how difficult is it to track down radio interference? Like, say, for example, on the 75-meter band at night. Let's say you have a station jamming on 75 meters.
Oh, okay. You're talking, okay, you're not talking electrical noise now. You're talking an actual station.
Right. Deliberate interference, and it's on 75, and it's late at night, and the station is probably, I'm going to use a hypothetical situation. Let's just say that you are in, say, Cincinnati, Ohio, and the offending station is in Chicago, Illinois. Now, how far can you go with direction-finding techniques that's available, let's say, to amateurs, to be able to pretty well near isolate where it's coming from? Or is it even possible because of Skywave?
Well, it's possible to get a direction-finding. If all that means is finding direction, you can do that with... You can do it with a loop, although one of the problems with a loop is, of course, a Skywave signal is not coming in straight on. It's coming in from an angle, and the angle you're talking about between Chicago and Cincinnati, I'm not that good at geography, but I'm going to have to guess that it's probably up there at 20, 25 degrees. So it's So maybe if you tilt the loop slightly, you could get a null, and you could determine the direction of the signal, and maybe from that tilt get an idea, if you know the height of the ionospheric layer that it's being propagated on, how far away it is just by knowing that tilt angle. Now, you're not going to be precise about it, but you might be able to tell that he's, well, if you had the choice of knowing that he's either in Chicago or Washington, D.C., you're going to be able to tell which of those two places he is.
Well, if you had two fellows doing this,
okay,
or possibly three that had some ideas to what they were doing, how close could they get to a general target area as to where it's coming from?
I haven't done a great deal of this on HF. I've done some experimenting, and I'll have to tell you maybe later on about the bad luck I had trying that on 40 meters. But the as I said, you can get a general idea, but there's no way you're going to actually be able to say for sure it's such and such a station unless you have somebody that's right there that can, you know, go to their house and track it with ground wave. Because ground wave is going to be, you know, much better than sky wave for doing this direction finding. But you can get an idea, for example, and people have done this, I understand it, on the clandestine stations and that sort of thing, is be able to tell whether they're in the USA or outside the USA or you know, get a pretty good idea of the general place they're coming from.
Well, and the reason why I ask is because for years, 75 meters has been the notorious band for notorious operators, you know, maybe 40 a little bit, but definitely 75, 80 meters. And I've had folks, I've heard two schools of thought. I've heard people say, well, you know, it's almost impossible to pin something down like that. You know, you're kind of at the jammer's mercy until they just get tired of it and go away, because unless there is someone located in the same town that they're in, trying to track it is really frustrating. Well, I've been told that. Then another friend of mine just told me, oh, my goodness, you would not believe the equipment that the FCC has, and they can locate a signal like that within a matter of feet as to, you know, where it's coming from. So, you know,
I think kind of both are right.
Okay, after hearing that, I've kind of wondered, you know, and then, of course, you kind of wonder, too, if that's the case, then why is it that this stuff goes on as much as it does? Why doesn't somebody, you know, triangulate on these people and knock on their door and say, hey, knock it off, you know?
Well, I can't say, because I don't know from firsthand experience that the FCC can get it down to a door from thousands of miles away, but I'm sure they would be able to determine what city or general locale it is, and then, of course, if they have agents in that area, they can certainly make progress locally. Clearly, the FCC and other agencies have equipment that is far superior to what the average ham has. Very few hams that I know of possess directional antennas for 75 meters that they use with any regularity. Certainly, they're not using them for transmitting. Certainly, the Adcock antenna is a better antenna than the loop from a directivity standpoint if the signal is high angle. But even then, you know, it's going to be pretty big on 75 meters.
So this isn't something like where you'd mount a quarter wave type beam on the three element beam on your bumper and drive around it.
And not on 75, that's for sure.
Well, you know, I was wondering, and I often wondered not just about loop antennas, but I wondered about things like, you know, these ferrite antennas. All these little AM radios have all had, you know, like I have a ferrite rod, and they have a coil wound around them, and you can take that radio in your hand and rotate it and completely null something almost out of existence, you know. Then hopefully the station you're listening to is in a different direction than the noise, so you can null the noise out and still get the station. But usually, the way it's always been with me, the noise and the station are all coming from the same direction, so you can't null them out. But how does something like that work for HFDFing? I mean, can you use...
Go ahead.
No, I'm asking about a ferrite type thing. Does that work? Does it work pretty good, or what would you use? Let's say you were tonight. You say, I have to go out and find me a 75-meter signal. What would you use?
Well, you're going to have to presume that it's something I can drive to, because otherwise I'm probably not going to be able to find it for you. But if I knew that there was a 75-meter signal that I wanted to find here locally, now whether that was some sort of noise or some sort of station that I wanted to find, either a loop or the ferrite rod could work. I will come at it from the thing I know best, which is on foot direction finding on 80 meters, and I hope at some point we'll be able to talk about this, but there are direction finding contests on foot in large parks on 80 meters nowadays. And the equipment that they use is little handheld units that consist of a receiver and a directional antenna. And they actually run around with these things, and they're actually smaller and easier to carry around than, say, a 2-meter beam would be for the 2-meter hunts. Many countries make them, and there's designs available, and people can easily use them. The typical antenna could be either a loop, which is typically maybe 6 or 8 inches. It's not that big, but it's multi-turn, and it's resonated with a capacitor, of course. Or it could be the ferrite bar. And again, that ferrite bar is just a big version of what's in your transistor radio. And either of them will work. Some would say that the air core or the big loop was going to work better because it has a bigger capture area, so it's going to hear the weak signals better. But if the signal is strong, either can work.
I've seen those, and you have to resonate them. And let's say that you're building one. Are there formulas available to wind the coil and the value of cap that you would use in order to get resonance on a particular frequency?
You can calculate the inductance by the standard inductor formula. I have actually built, because I had to find some interference, this was power line interference. Actually, it was noise on the power line. It wasn't coming from the power line on 80 meters. And I built an antenna just for this, and I have actually, I believe, published plans in one of my articles, and it is built on a PVC frame. It's just a cross made of PVC pipe, and then the antenna is wound in a diamond shape on it. And it is probably, and I wanted a big one because I was going to put it on my car, so I think this diamond is about, 2 foot by 2 foot, maybe even 3 foot. And it's, I think, only about 4 or 5 turns of wire, probably, say, number 22 wire enameled, that sort of thing. And my recollection is it's like a 100 picofarad capacitor that I have across it, and it resonated very nicely. And then I put a small loop of wire inside, maybe 1 or 2 turns, maybe 3 or 4 inches in diameter, and that is coupled to it, and that couples off the signal without affecting the directivity very much.
Well, let me ask you this question. How can you tell when you hit resonance by tuning the cap? I mean, do you tune the cap until you get it resonant to the frequency you're trying to work? And I'm curious how do you go about doing that?
Well, it's pretty high Q circuit. So there's not a lot of resistive losses in there. So what basically happens is you listen on the radio, and as you tune through resonance, the noise and signals will just pop right up.
Well, that makes sense. I've seen that kind of thing before. You know, years ago, I remember they used to make little loop antennas that actually had a little handle on it and a suction cup. And you would fasten it onto your window and roll the window up somehow, and the thing would stay outside, and you had the little handle to flip it back and forth. And I guess once you oriented your car in a certain direction, and they had a little trimmer cap on those, and those, I believe, were designed specifically for Citizens Band. That's been long ago. I just remember seeing those things.
And I can't say that I ever have, although it makes sense. On 10 or 11 meters, a loop that is maybe 1-2 feet in diameter, one turn, and oftentimes is made out of something like a quarter-inch tubing like you'd use to hook up the water to your refrigerator ice maker, is easily resonated by a capacitor, and I don't remember the exact value, but again, it's probably in the order of 40, 50 picofarads.
That's what these were. These were a single piece of aluminum tubing. The whole thing was made out of aluminum, and I just barely remember how they were made. I just remember there was a suction cup or a couple of suction cups where you could actually, wet the suction cup and stick it on the window of your automobile and roll it out, roll the window up, which would put the loop up above the roof of the car. And then you would use the little, and I often wondered, too, how much interaction you'd get from the car body, being a ground plane.
I think you would.
I wonder how much that would throw off this the directional coil. But, you know, of course, none of these guys that had them had a clue as to how they, as to what they were doing with them. They would just drive around with them on their cars, I think. It made them look important. But, anyways.
The receiver needs to have a very good RF gain control, too, because otherwise, you know, you're trying to detect a null. So you've got to knock the signal down to where you can detect that null.
Okay, now, I was going to ask now, in regards to doing, you know, DF work, and as you're getting into transmitter hunts and all those kind of things, you were talking about little portable units and people hunting in the park, and I see quite a little bit every once in a while. I see things on fox hunts. You know, guys are doing fox hunts, and they'll be very creative as to where they're hiding the transmitters. Now, usually those things done citywide, or are they more or less confined into a smaller area? How have you seen this go, let's say, as of late?
Well, I think what you're mostly talking about is what we call mobile transmitter hunts, or tee hunts. Sometimes they're called bunny hunts, rabbit hunts, that sort of thing. And they're done in cars, so we're not talking about the on-foot now, except maybe at the end you may have to go a ways on foot because the transmitter may not be like right next to a road. But we're talking about something that is generally citywide. And certainly it's done in many areas of the country. It's done in Chicago. It's done in Cincinnati. It's done in Albuquerque. It's done in Boston. And you know, there's these groups that have been doing it. Now, I live in Southern California, and as I said, we've been doing it there since before I started in about 1976. They were doing it in the 50s with the old Gonset communicators and that sort of thing on 2 meters. But now, of course, it's a lot more, certainly a lot more modern. And because it's more modern, the receivers are much more sensitive. So when we do our hunts, and of course we're in mountainous country, and so sometimes the signals are actually reflected off mountains and that sort of thing, but we're all using very sensitive equipment. We're using Yagis or quads that give us some gain. So the signals can be for a ways. The smallest boundaries of the mobile hunts that I regularly go on are maybe, well, they're actually based on maps, but typically, if I was speaking in miles, there may be 20 miles from the starting point, and that's the smallest ones. Some of the other night hunts have boundaries that are maybe 40 or 50 miles from the starting point, and we have what are called the all-day hunts every month in Southern California, and all-day is a misnomer because it really can be all weekend. They start from a hilltop in Palos Verdes, California, and that sees all the way down to practically to San Diego and up to Santa Barbara and out into the desert. So if you can get a signal back into there, the hunt is on. And there have been hiders that have been 300 miles away or more and able to get a signal into Palos Verdes, and that can make for a very long transmitter hunt.
Wow, I can imagine, 300 miles. You'd have to pack several lunches.
That's right.
Well, how good can somebody get at this? How you know I want to think that this is this is a lot of technique. In other words, not as much of the equipment. The equipment's important, but I'm just thinking in my own mind that eventually a person starts to hone in skills in this department, and they get to where they really have a feel for what they're doing. Now, is this just my imagination, or is this the case?
Well, it's definitely true, and the proof of that, of course, is that, you know, there is such a thing as beginner's luck, but for the most part, there'll be people that will come out and go on some of these more advanced hunts, and they're not going to win a hunt for quite a few times until they develop a certain amount of skill and learn from their mistakes and get better and better, and then they start winning. So clearly there is a learning curve. You need to, you know, it's not something, and when I give my talks to radio clubs, I say, you know, people think, well, what could be hard about transmitter hunting? You just turn your beam until you get a signal. You go in that direction. The signal gets stronger. A few minutes later, you get there, and everybody goes out for a bite to eat. Well, it's not that simple, because hiders have ways, and they learn that very well, too. They learn by doing that. They can make the hunt harder. They can do it by the signal parameters, by making the signal difficult to copy, by how often it's on or off, that sort of thing, if the hunt rules allow it. They can conceal the transmitter, put it somewhere where, you know, in hide it inside something so you don't recognize it when you come on it, and you better know your equipment. But the most dastardly ones involve, particularly with 2-meter signals, bouncing the signals off the mountains or other terrain objects. So when you are at Palos Verdes and you turn your antenna around and it points at Mount Baldy, which is in itself, you know, 40, 50 miles away, you don't know if the signal's really coming from that mountain or if it's being reflected from somewhere in San Diego County by a guy that's down there with a very long beam. So you kind of learn a little bit. You kind of learn, well, gee whiz, if the signal's really broad across the face of the mountains, then it could be, it's more likely it's a reflection than if that bearing is really sharp, like he's right there on the mountain and you're just, you know, right, you're looking right at him. So you learn how to do things like that, and you take advantage of airplane bounces and things like that, and you do get better. And the more you do it, the better you get.
I guess if you wanted to bounce it off of an object, I've often wondered if you couldn't, you know, aim a beam at something that you, I'm just trying to think, like a building in an area that has a lot of metal in it, you know, that would act as a reflector. Would that not just drive everybody crazy? I mean, would that not scatter the thing off? And
you have to be really careful, because when you're aiming at that building, you may be aiming at something else that's going to scatter it too. So you may get multiple sources, and that may be good or bad. There are stories about hunts that take place down in the warehouse district or down by the docks in Los Angeles, where there are these, you know, all these big oil refinery tanks and that sort of thing, and somebody aims it at a few of those, and you know, you get these multiple reflections from all these tanks. So it's the multiple reflections that can really drive you crazy, because you can get, once you're down in among them, you're not really getting a direct signal anymore. All the signals you're getting is coming by reflection, and maybe it's multiple reflections.
So actually, you could get multiple reflections and be right in the middle of those, and the transmitter be several miles away from there.
It certainly can be. That can happen. So you have to pay attention to not only the direction, but the signal strength. And you may want to just move completely away from the area and try to find a really high spot that you can look down on the situation from, and try to pinpoint it that way, and then go where that tells you to go.
Well, the other thing I wondered about too, you know, the receivers today, for the most part, are so sensitive. I mean, they really are sensitive. I mean, compared to what we worked with when we were kids, you know, and does that not also play havoc? In other words, would you have to use some sort of attenuators while you're working with this stuff, have some way of attenuating signals going into the receivers and possibly even remoting the front panel meter, up higher and on a bigger meter or something where you could actually see it a little bit better? Or how do you work? I can't imagine trying to do this, with an HT. I mean, to me, that would just be...
Well, some people do, and it's tough, because how do you walk around and see that little teeny meter on that HT at night in the dark, you know? And oh, by the way, your battery's going to be drained by the time you get the hunt is over. So most people, and this is a case where some old surplus equipment can work really well, because some of these transceivers of the 70s and 80s that don't have all this surface mount stuff and are easy to work on, can be really good for transmitter hunting, because what the transmitter hunters out here will do is they will do what you just said, which is they will find a nice big meter and mount it on the panel, or excuse me, on the dashboard of the vehicle, and they'll hook that up, maybe with a little amplifier, into the meter tap off, the S meter tap off of the radio, and that will certainly help them, or they may use the little bar graph ICs and make a bar graph that maybe isn't just 5 or 6 or 8 bars, but it might be 40 or 50, because that gives them a little bit more fine detail as to the strength of the signal. And yes, they definitely need an attenuator, an RF attenuator between the antenna and the receiver. That's one way to do it, and probably the most common way to do it. Typically, when we start out our mobile hunts on top of a hilltop, the signal may be barely breaking the squelch, or it may be stronger, it may be half scale or so. Once you get off that hill, it may very well go down again, but as you get closer and closer, you're going to be putting in those dBs. And a typical attenuator, you will need to get 70 or 80 dB of attenuation by the time you get close if the hider is running 10, 15, or more watts. Because, as you say, the receiver will be overloaded otherwise, and you wouldn't be able to get a bearing with your beam at all. And sometimes even that's not enough. and the signal just goes right around the attenuator and into the case. So some of us modify our receivers, and again, here's where a surplus radio is great for this. You go in and you find all the various control ways to control the RF stage, maybe the first oscillator, maybe the first IF stage. You either control the B-plus to that, or if it's a FET, you control the gate voltage to that, and you can use internal attenuation, the receiver, to get where you can walk right up to a transmitter and still be able to knock down the signal enough to get a bearing.
I want to change course just a little bit here, because you're the man to talk to about this. Today, I don't guess there's a whole lot of folks that are alive that can testify to the nastiness of a spark gap transmitter. If you've ever heard one on the air.
Oh, yes.
Not
first person, but yes, every once in a while at Hamfest we'll have them.
But they can really, really generate some mess. Spectral.
You certainly can.
Spectral garbage, if you want to call it. Well, the thing that you know, working in AM radio, especially broadcast radio, and even shortwave, the one thing that I'm finding that's very, very neglected, and it doesn't seem to be getting anyone's attention, and that is how nasty power lines are getting. We've got power lines not too far from where I live that if I get up to an intersection and I'm within, say, a half a mile to three-fourths of a mile from that intersection, I cannot pick up WSM, which is a 50,000-watt AM station in the Nashville area, and I'm maybe 10 miles from their transmitter site, which means that whatever that is that is coming off those power lines has got to be horrendous in terms of power level. And I've wondered, have you ever done any direction finding of power line noise?
Yes, and it's, of course, with your AM radio that's tuned to WSM, you're not going to be able to do much direction finding with it for a couple of reasons. Number one, you notice that let's say it's a very long power line. That noise could be anywhere along that power line. How do you know if it's here or if it's a mile down the road? Because that power line is conducting that noise almost perfectly, so radiating the entire length. So let's say I had a loop antenna and I took a bearing and I said, "Yep, it's that power line that I'm looking at, and it's 50 feet away." But where along that power line is it? Because anywhere I tune along that line is radiating. So where am I going to find a null? Every null is filled in, no matter what direction you turn it. So the way you hunt power line interference is you start going up in frequency. And you keep going up in frequency. Let's say if you're a mile away from the offending power line, you may only hear it up to maybe 5-6 megahertz, let's say. So you probably, if you're a mile away, you can probably get a bearing toward the power line and you head in that direction. Now you're getting closer, but you want to find out where it is along that power line. So you start going up in frequency. And generally speaking, when you get up really high, you get up into VHF, maybe even 2 meters, and of course you need an AM receiver for this, not FM. Now you're getting to the point where the 2 meter part of that noise does not travel as far on the power line, so it's a little easier to locate. It's a little easier to get bearings on. And you keep going up and up and up, and the higher you go, you know, the closer you get, the higher you'll be able to go. And you'll be able to come right, probably find the offending part of the power line that way.
Well, you know, I guess the thing of it is that I've noticed that this is something that that seems to have just fallen by the wayside. Nobody seems to follow through on it. Years ago, I lived in the Detroit area, and the Detroit Edison Company used to go out, and you would see these fellas that had it looked like a long pole and a loop at the end of the pole, and they had on a pair of headphones, and they would travel up and down these power lines looking for arcs. And when they found one, they'd put it to rest. You know, they whatever they would do. I mean, they'd go in and tighten up connections or do whatever they had to do. And I asked a fellow once about that. I said, "Well, why? You know, why do they do that?" Of course, when I was younger, I had no idea how much actual radio interference it cost. And he said, "Well," he said, "every one of these things consumes power." And he said, if we close them all off, if we go through, it's like leaks in a water hose. He said, if we go through the power system and eliminate all the arcs, he said, we're saving quite a bit of energy. And I never thought about that. And I thought, well, you know, that when as I got older, I began to think about it. I thought, well, you know, that makes a lot of sense now that I'm older. I understand what he's talking about. But it does make sense. And it just doesn't. It doesn't seem like power companies pay any attention to this anymore. And I've seen noise in an area where you'd have this loud grinding sound, you know, and it would take up a chunk of the AM broadcast band, sometimes the entire band. Depending on where you were. And I have followed this noise here in Nashville sometimes as much as 5 and 6 miles away is where the actual source would be. And by hook or by crook, and using this little device that a friend of mine had that is made by MFJ. I don't know if you've ever seen these things. Another Martin Jew creation.
And, is it four power lines? Is it specifically for power
lines? It's got two little antennas that come off to the side, and there's a meter, and I don't know what else is there, but we used it and tracked it, and we actually got down to the source, and it was like 5 miles away. And when we got right by the power line at night, you could see the arc, you know, and that arc was transmitting 5 miles across town, just wiping AM reception completely out.
And it may have been that device that the other fellow was using. I believe they detect power line flaws in other ways too, ultrasonics and corona detectors and that sort of thing. So I'm not sure if the fellow using was actually a radio direction finder or something else. But the power line companies here, and I am not an expert on this, so I don't want to say good or bad things about the power company because I'd be speaking about something I don't know anything about really. But it's my understanding that once you get their attention, the power line companies must, because Laura Smith sends them letters, and will try to find the interference. But you're right; they probably don't have people out on patrol doing it. It has to be brought to their attention.
Well, I think it's just a matter of the day and time we live in. I just think it's kind of it's become a kind of a forgotten thing, you know. But when you think about it, you have a little neighborhood radio station. Now we've got a bunch of these here. As a matter of fact, we've been doing a little work on an AM station that puts out 500 watts. And you get very far away, their field strength is not that much to speak of. And if you've got a little like a General Electric Super Radio or something that's halfway decent on the AM band and you're listening around, it doesn't take much to wipe one of those guys right out, I mean, as far as power line noise. And, you know, there was another fella that made some stuff. I believe the guy's name was Khan, spelled K-A-H-N. He made a device that went on an AM transmitter, and I can't remember how this thing worked. It went on a commercial broadcast transmitter, and I think he called it PowerSide or something. But what it was designed in such a way that when you transmitted it, it helped eliminate what he called power line re-radiation. And I never even knew there was such a thing. But power lines actually will re-radiate other signals. And cause problems in terms of reception. I had never heard of this, didn't know it. And then later on, I found out how little I did know. There is such a thing. And you were talking about tracking a signal to a power line, but the signal was not actually coming from the power line itself, but the power line was re-radiating it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, because I'm interested in hearing this.
Well, that can happen. I'm not sure that's what I was speaking of, but you are correct that power lines can re-radiate. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering if any of those stations that you've worked with, because I did this when I was in college, I had directional antennas. And that's one of the problems of AM broadcast, is that some of these stations that have directional antennas that have to null out certain places to certain directions in order to protect other stations on the same or adjacent frequencies, and a new power line in the area can really mess up the pattern from these stations, because it will take power from the main lobe and radiate it off in the unwanted direction and affect the pattern. I don't know if that's been an experience of yours, but it certainly can happen.
Well, I know nowadays when they put up cell towers, it's a requirement. The FCC requires the cell tower people that are putting it up to look at the area and see if there's an AM broadcast station in the area. If there is, they have to detune that tower. They have to put a skirt on it and actually detune it so that it does not interfere with the pattern of the AM station. So it only stands to reason that a power line. Now, let me tell you this. When I was a kid, I was addicted to phono oscillators. Do you know what those are?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, I was a phono oscillator addict, okay? And I had the little L-shaped chassis that Lafayette Radio made, and I had the one that was the night kit that had the three tubes with a hot chassis that if you didn't pay attention, you could it'd blow the plug right out of the wall if you were grounded to something. But anyways, those little things I learned as a kid, and I had no idea what I was doing. In the backyard of my house, there was the telephone lines were located in a I don't know how to describe it. It was a big fat cable, and on the outside of that cable was something that almost looked like the consistency of a tomato soup can. It was a metal sheath that ran the entire length of these cables, and it was metal. And I assume it was grounded. It had to be. Or at least it was grounded to DC, if you follow what I'm saying. Well, I learned that if I lassoed that line, if I went up there and I ran a copper wire and wrapped it around there a couple times so I had me a good tight connection, you know, an electrical connection, I could run that thing back in and attach it to my phono oscillator, which put out maybe 50 milliwatts. And my word, that thing would go and go and go. And if anyway, you could go a mile away if you took the radio and brought it up next to the telephone in the house. The signal would just come right in. So I had a little carrier current station is what I wound up having. And
fortunately for you, I think the statute of limitations has run out on that.
But if you took it, because I had all my friends in the school listening, and you could, because I didn't know how to cut an antenna or resonate something. I didn't know. That was way over my head. But if you took your transistor radio and put it up near the telephone, it'd mm-hmm. come in like a champ. And I mean, as much as a mile away. And, of course, 50 milliwatts was not enough to really, it wouldn't cause any audio interference to the phone lines. The power level is just too low. But it worked really well. I mean, it really, really worked. So if you were to stop and think about it, I mean, carrier current has been something that's been around on all the college campuses where they actually tune the transmitter into the power lines so that it's a suitable load to the transmitter, but the RF is transferred into the power lines. And so the power lines actually operate as an antenna. And, of course, I guess that works until it hits a transformer. But it stands to reason that a power line placed near a radio transmitter would pick up the RF, and that RF would travel for as long as it can go until it actually hits something that attenuates it, which would be, you know, a transformer or a substation or something along that line. Now, am I right or wrong? You can correct me here on this one because I don't know.
Well, it is. Of course, there's, you know, it depends on, again, the frequency and the resonance and what other lossy things are. And, of course, the power lines are usually horizontal, and the radio transmitter is often transmitting with a vertical antenna, so the coupling may not be as good that from that standpoint. But I am not the expert on that particular thing. I can maybe find them with direction finding, but I'll confess that I haven't ever attempted to do what you just said, so I can't speak as an expert on that.
Well, now that I've really detoured the conversation way off the beating path here, let's get back to your on-foot transmitter hunting. And I noticed that you're involved in a number of things. It says here there's a VHF article that was in CQ. I see on your website, and I see registration is now open for the 10th USA ARDF Championship. So tell us a little bit about this stuff.
That's kind of a whole different flavor of radio direction finding for sport, as opposed to the mobile transmitter hunts that I was telling you about. That kind of developed here in the USA because, well, let's face it, we all like our automobiles, and we like to do ham radio in our automobiles, and mobiling used to be the big thing in the 50s, right, in ham radio in the USA. Well, it wasn't over in Europe. And right after World War II and maybe into the early 50s, some of the countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, but also the Scandinavian countries, were the ham radio operators there were combining direction finding with orienteering. Now, I've got to back off a minute and talk a little bit about orienteering. I presume most of your listeners know that, or particularly if they were Boy Scouts, what orienteering was like. That was the map and compass sport, where you had a map and were able to find your way through the woods. And of course, orienteering itself is a worldwide sport that is practiced by a lot more people than practice ham radio transmitter hunting. But there are orienteering societies all over. They orienteering events that you get a map, which is a kind of a topo map on steroids, because it has markings that give you an idea of what the vegetation is like, whether it's forested or whether you can easily run through it, or whether it's impassable, that sort of thing. And at orienteering meets, they mark the what they call controls on the map, and you have to navigate your way to each control and punch in and then get to the finish. And there may be, say, 20 controls or so on a long course. Well, in radio orienteering, you get the same map, and you take your same compass, but they don't mark the controls on the map. The controls are radio transmitters, and you have to find your way to them. And that's what this sport kind of, as I said, developed in the 50s. I think the first world championships did not take place until 1980, and the only countries that participated in it were European countries. And it didn't come to, then some of the Asian countries got involved a little bit later on, Korea, China was very big in it. And it didn't really come to the USA. Well, the first time we participated in the World Championships was 1998, so that'll give you an idea how new it is here. But a number of people, and it was sparked in some respects by some people from Eastern European countries who were here in the United States and had experienced it as youth there in their native lands, and they kind of brought it to the hams here, and some of the hams who were particularly into fitness and running and sport took it up and said, hey, this is great. We'd like to get involved in this. So the first USA direction-finding championships did take place 10 years ago, and we've been doing it every year ever since, and we've been sending teams to the World Championships. This year, we're going to have a championships in Ohio in the weekend after the Dayton Hamvention, so that'll be, I believe, the 22nd and the 23rd of May. And then the people that do the best in that one and the one we had last year are going to go to the World Championships, which will be in Croatia in September. So it's becoming a very popular sport in some places in the USA for hams who are really into fitness.
Well, I've noticed there's an article here on the CQ Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend. And I notice you have a link to that on the site, on your website. Incidentally, let's give out your website address, because we're going to sit here and talk, and we're not going to do this. And then people
maybe some of these people would like to look it up right now while we're talking about it.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to close out something on my computer, and it's not cooperating, so I can't see the website address. Why don't you give the website address for us here?
Okay, well, while you're doing that, I'll tell them it is www, of course, homingin.com, like you're homing in on something, H-O-M-I-N-G-I-N. No spaces, no dashes, no anything like that, because otherwise you get some really strange sites. But it's just homingin.com. Now, while you're doing that, I will mention that the CQ Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend is a separate activity, but it's something we've been doing now. This will be the 13th annual CQ Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend, and it all started 13 years ago when I was talking to the editor of CQ Magazine. We were corresponding, and he wanted to do something about, CQ is a contesting magazine, and they sponsor some really great contests. And he knew that hams like to do direction-finding contests, and he thought, this might be a really good contest for us to put on. And I said, well, I don't know how you'd do a real contest on the air nationwide. I said, but how about we make it an activity weekend? So that's exactly what we did. We pick a weekend every spring, and we encourage clubs around the country to hold direction-finding events. And this year, as has been a couple of years, we're making it the same weekend as the USA Championships. But that's just for convenience and to get more people involved, because although we'll have several dozen people at the national championships, there will also be people all over the USA, clubs, groups, that will be putting on hidden transmitter hunts, both mobile, on foot, other kinds, and just having fun with radio direction finding. And both the April and May issues this year of CQ Magazine will have articles about it and pictures and stories about last year's hunts and can kind of tell people what it's like. And if you want to see what fox hunting is like, then that's a really great way to do it.
Now, the fellow you're talking to, are you talking about Richard Moseson or?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
WTVU.
Now, let me ask you a question. Can Richard fox hunt okay? Can he do all right with that? Or
I haven't. You know, he's never told me one way or the other, and he's on the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast, so I can't say that I've had an opportunity to observe. Maybe you should ask him that sometime.
Well, he's been a guest on the show several times, and of course, we always see him at Dayton at the CQ booth, so I'll have to ask him how well he does with this fox hunting thing.
I think that'd be great.
Let me ask one question here, because we're getting a little short on time, and think of anything else that you want to mention before we have to say goodbye. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Joe Mell, right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. You're listening to QSO, and now back to our guest, Joe Mell. I've seen some fellows using some things that almost look like parabolas. Do they work well for fox hunting, or are the loops actually better for this sort of thing?
Well, again, it depends on the band. I mean, we've actually had some people hold transmitter hunts on, you know, microwave and UHF frequencies. We had a 440 megahertz transmitter hunts locally here for a while. We've had we even had a 1.2 gigahertz hunt at one of the conventions, and you know, a small dish there might actually do a pretty good job. But outside of microwaves, I think true dishes, if you're talking about a dish say the size of a dish network dish or something like that.
Well, I've seen them different sizes, and I had one fellow tell me that he had a tuned dipole located in the center of this dish, and the thing was loaded and all this kind of stuff, and he said it worked fantastic. And the technology was over my head, because it was I think he was using it on 2 meters is what he was doing, and I thought this awful bulky antenna be carrying around, but he seemed to like it.
I think it had to be a pretty big dish to be effective on 2 meters. That would be a little bit much. It's so easy to make like a Yagi out of tape measure material or something like that, or to make a quad out of PVC pipe or fiberglass spreaders and wire. It's so easy to make those antennas, and they work so well that I'm not sure why anybody would use anything else. Loops are possible. As a matter of fact, you can buy a loop from Aero Antenna Company. that will work on VHF, and I know some of the fellows near where you are in Tennessee are using those loops in some of the local park hunts, but they aren't nearly as sensitive as a Yagi, and they are bidirectional, so, you know, you could be going 180 degrees in the wrong direction if you use a loop, so that's also something to consider.
Oh, the loop, you almost have to have several bearings on the device, where a Yagi is going to be a lot more pinpoint, I would think, you know, in rotating it, you're going to be able to tell a lot more.
Yes.
Unless, like you're saying, you're fired up in a on a directional. We used to run into this a lot in broadcast radio when we were doing remotes and using Yagi antennas there, and that is a lot of times pointing the Yagi at the radio station did you no good. You wound up way off pointing it off in some, you know, some really bizarre direction, but that was where the maximum signal was coming from, and it was obviously being reflected from something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we never did concern ourselves as to what it was being reflected off of. We were just interested in getting a strong signal.
Unless in the middle of the remote the something moved, like if it was a big truck or something like that, and you lost your signal.
There you go. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to this? This is very, very interesting, and I'd like folks to be sure and go to your website, which is homingin.com, homingin. And take a look, because you've got an awful lot of stuff up there. You've got links and articles, and I see a link here on fox boxes. I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff up here. And if a person's interested in fox hunting, this is the website to encounter. Is there anything else you'd like to add to all this?
Well, certainly, I think my friends that are trying to promote direction finding in other countries would want me to mention that for your listeners in outside the USA, Central South America, anywhere here in the Western Hemisphere, or for that matter, anywhere that's within the sound of our voice, that your country probably has an ARDF program, and if it doesn't, you might want to consider getting together with some friends and starting one. It's very, very easy to get started in the on-foot hunting. As I said, it's, you know, one of the things we do at, we have on-foot hunts in the park just while we're training our team, but we're also bringing beginners into it. And we do it about every month here in Southern California. And we'll have an antenna clinic. And what we'll do is somebody will bring some kits of these measuring tape Yagis. And a measuring tape Yagi is something that if you bought all the parts new at Home Depot, they couldn't cost more than about $10-$15. It's made out of an old steel measuring tape and some PVC pipe and a little bit of coax and a little hairpin match, and the plans are on the web, you know, no charge for the plans. You can put one of these things together in an hour, and that and your handy talkie will get you started in direction finding. You'll probably want a simple attenuator, but plans for that are available, and again, that's something that you can put together for about the same price. So it doesn't cost a lot to get in it. You can use the radio that you already have. If you have a 2-meter radio, either a scanner with an S meter or a handy talkie, use what you have, and you could be experiencing direction finding. And it's a great thing for young people. Let's face it, they probably have to be 8, 9, 10, 11 years old to be able to hold up the antenna. But beyond that, it's a great, if you're looking for a way to get the local scouts, the local kids, the local schools interested in radio, what a neat thing to do. Put one of these antennas into their hand and point out to them that this is the same technology that is used by the people that keep track of wildlife, these tagged critters that are out there. It's the same technology, and they can pretend that they're doing that, and they'll get so excited about it that you can teach them more and more about radios and signal propagation. It's such a wonderful way for kids to learn about radio and have fun and get exercise at the same time. So I would encourage anyone to read about it and to try it locally. If you're looking for an activity for your club, this is a great one.
Well, our guest has been Joe Mell, and his last name is spelled M-O-E-L-L. The O is silent. His call sign is K0OV. And the website is homingin.com. That's www.homingin.com. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest and for talking about this. We'll have to have you back because There's so much more territory that we could cover and things we could talk about here. And I think we will have sparked an interest in a lot of folks, and they're going to want to hear more. So we're going to have to do this again very soon.
Thanks very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's going to do it for this week's edition of QSO. We want to thank our guests, Jeff Murray and Joe Mell, for being our guest on this edition of QSO. Be sure and tune in again for another edition of QSO.